I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama was barnstorming the country, touting programs focused on those who have not benefited from the improving economy, mostly middle and working class households. He's called for tax increases on the rich, middle class tax cuts and credits, paid family and sick leave, and free tuition for community college students. It's doubtful that Republicans, now firmly in control of the Congress, will applaud those proposals when Obama delivers his State of the Union tonight. He will no doubt tout the fact that hiring is up, unemployment is down, and the U.S. economy has been recovering since the Great Recession. Today in Radio Times, we assess the strengths and the weaknesses of the U.S. economy. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Mark Zandi, chief economist for Moody's Analytics, wrote a book a couple of years ago called Paying the Price, Ending the Great Recession and Beginning a New American Century. Mark Zandi, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Neil Irwin. In fact, joining us from the studios of the New York Times, he's senior economic correspondent at the New York Times. The Upshot wrote a book called The Alchemists, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire. Neil Irwin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
Mark, let me begin with you. You had a piece recently, 2014, a good year for the U.S. economy, 2015, probably even better.
Yeah, 2014 was a good year. You can see that best through the job market. We created 3 million jobs last year. The quality of the jobs improved. Early in the recovery, it was mostly low-paying. Now we're seeing job creation across the board. Unemployment declined by more than a percentage point. We're still not quite there yet, but we're closing in on full employment pretty quickly. By this time next year, I think we'll be there. And 2015 should be a good year for lots of reasons.
And I want to pick up on that. Let me give you, Neil, just a chance to weigh in on, as you look back on 2014, what do you see as the strengths and weaknesses?
You know, as Mark mentions, what we saw was a real step up in the pace of job growth. That's clearly the strength. We were adding something like 2.5 million jobs a year now. More like 3 million jobs a year. That's rapidly putting Americans back to work. The unemployment rate, 5.6% in December, that's really, you know, that's not terrible. That's what it was in 2004, for example, which we don't remember as some horrible year. So we are seeing this healing. The weaknesses, I'm sure we'll get into this in more detail in a bit, circle on wages, on the real spread of this recovery and this expansion to create higher incomes and higher quality of life for Americans across the country.
Neil, are you surprised that gas prices or oil prices have taken such a quick tumble?
Yeah, I don't think anybody saw that coming. You know, just last summer, back in June, we were at north of $100 a barrel. Now more like $45 or $50 a barrel for oil. That's translating, of course, into lower gasoline prices. You see on Twitter people posting photos of their neighborhood gas station and the you know, sub $2 a gallon gasoline prices on the signs. You know, this was kind of a black swan, as they say. This was an unexpected event that was kind of out of the range of what people thought was likely. We can talk about the reasons, but the upshot is that it's a piece of good news if you're trying to pay for that commute, and so it is something that increases effectively real incomes for Americans because you have the same paycheck coming in and you have less money going out to pay for your commute.
And how much more money, Mark, for the sort of average American?
Lots. So last year in 2014, we paid $3.50 on average for a gallon of gasoline. If oil prices stay roughly where they are, we'll pay about $2 a gallon.
Wow.
At my local Wawa, though, we're still paying $2.22, so we're not quite there yet. We're headed in the direction.
But still, yeah. Still a dramatic drop.
And here's a factoid for you. Every penny decline in the cost of gasoline saves American consumers $1.2 billion over a period of a year. So you can kind of do the arithmetic. This is $150-200 billion in savings to American consumers.
I can't do the math fast enough. What does that mean for an individual consumer?
Well, you know, that's we're talking lots of money. I have to do that in that arithmetic in my mind too. But it's several hundred dollars a year, I think, in savings.
Why, Neil, then, has the stock market been going nuts? And it seems like the stock market doesn't, broadly speaking, doesn't seem like it's very happy about these low oil prices.
I mean, it's important not to overstate what goes on in the stock market. We were at record highs just a few weeks ago, and it's come off a little since then. Markets move for a lot of different reasons. There is this sense of geopolitical fear, and especially in the European economy, there's some real sluggishness. There's instability coming out of the areas that produce oil and are actually suffering because of lower oil prices, Russia especially. Will they act out? Will that create more geopolitical tremors? But, you know, it's important to remember the stock market is way up over the last 5 years. years. And a little sell-off is not anything that's going to radically impact people's ability to buy the things they need.
But I'm wondering about companies, Mark, perhaps that make pipelines or steel makers. I mean, are they hurt by these low gas oil prices?
Oh, yeah, sure. So, you know, there's winners and losers in this. And the losers are the energy companies and anyone has anything to do with the energy companies. And they're already pulling back. The number of rigs out there operating is coming down 50 a week. And we're seeing cuts in 50 jobs.
50 a week?
50 a week.
Is that a lot? That's
a lot.
That seems like a lot.
Yeah, and it's only intensifying. So, you know, parts of the country that had been doing well, booming, Texas, North Dakota, are now going to struggle. So this isn't a positive across the board. There are negatives. But net-net, we still as a nation are a consumer of oil and energy. Mm. So when its price declines, it's like a tax cut, and it's a pretty hefty tax cut. So that $150, $200 billion in saving is about 1%, a little over 1% of your disposable income. That is consequential, and that will – that positive will overwhelm the negatives.
Now, why, though, looking back since the Great Recession, what of 07, 08, 09, why has it been that middle-class families, perhaps even working lower-class families, why have they not been able to get some of the benefits of this improving economy?
You know, there are a lot of factors, and some of them are long term. So we've had this, you know, 20, 30 year period in which there's been a disconnect between overall GDP growth and rising incomes for the middle class and lower income Americans. There's an exciting debate, an interesting debate on why that is. There's globalization, there's technological change that changes the nature of skills you need in a modern economy. There's policy changes that weaken labor unions, for example. So that's an interesting debate, and those are long term things that have been happening for decades. The question is, how do those interact with the cyclical things, the things that happened because of the recession that we're still trying to claw our way out of? And that's an interesting dynamic, because what you saw is since 2009, since the economy bottomed out in mid-2009, we've seen a pretty rapid growth in stock market valuations, in incomes at the upper end of the spectrum. We've seen much more modest growth in the middle class. So, for example, median incomes in 2013 were still below their 2009 levels and inflation-adjusted levels. That's a remarkable thing when you consider how much the economy's grown, how much the stock market's grown since then. You know, the question is, did something about this recession and this the way this played out really accentuate and further those longer-term secular trends that happen over longer time horizons? And I think it's really a bit of a mystery for economists. I think there's still a debate and still trying to figure out exactly how these factors interact and what's causing what. When you see this picture of median incomes, middle class incomes that aren't really gaining so far.
You want to add to that? And Mark, you had a piece recently predicting that wages were going to go up in 2015 and perhaps have begun to go up for a number of working people.
Yeah, the pace of growth to accelerate. I think Neil has it exactly right. There's these broader long-term structural forces at work that have led to the skewing of the distribution of income and wealth. But there's also cyclical forces, and the recession was severe. Unemployment peaked at 10%. Now we've come down. We're at 5.6%. But full employment, it's an estimate, but it's probably somewhere around 5. And as we create lots of jobs, and that's what we're doing, unemployment comes in and we approach that 5% unemployment rate. Mm. I do anticipate that we will see wage growth, which has been stuck around 2%, stuck around the rate of inflation, to accelerate. And that's, I think, one of the reasons to be optimistic about 2015 going into 16, particularly for the first time, middle-income and lower-income households who, as you point out, have not benefited to a significant degree from what's been going on.
So why would employers pay more? I mean, what has changed that salaries or wages would go up?
They have no choice, because the labor market is now tightening. People are quitting their jobs because they have other job opportunities. I mean, for example, the number of job openings in the economy today is as high as it's ever been in the data that we have. Now, we've got data back into the early 90s, so it's not a long time series, but we now have a record number of job openings. And the number of people who are quitting their jobs without another job, which is a good sign that they feel pretty confident that they'll find one, is now picking up quite significantly as well. So all the kind of leading indicators that would suggest wage growth is going to pick up are coming into place. And I would be very surprised if, when you invite me back next year, hopefully, we're not talking about an acceleration in wage growth and real wage gains, meaning wage growth that's better than the rate of inflation, so people's standard of living is starting to improve, and it will feel more broad-based. And in fact, people are already feeling it. I mean, you saw it in some of the President Obama's ratings. They're up, and they're up because, in large part, because the economy is feeling better, and people are now starting to recognize that.
Do you share that optimism, Neil?
I do. You know, it's funny. One way to think of it is that employers have had a pretty easy time in terms of hiring, recruiting, retaining workers over the last 6-7 years. When the unemployment rate is 10% and you're an employer, your workers, they're scared to death that they're going to lose their job. They know there aren't other jobs down the street. So really, the employer's in a very good position to not give raises, to give small raises, to even cut pay. And know that the workers aren't gonna go down the street because there's nobody hiring down the street. That changes as we get to now 5.6% unemployment. If we head toward 5 or even under 5, that entire dynamic starts to shift. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, if you're an employer, you do have to worry that your workers are gonna go down the street to get a better deal somewhere else. At some point, the advantage in business competition goes to the employer that's more aggressive in hiring and giving raises to do that. We just saw last week Aetna, the giant health insurer, said they're gonna set a minimum floor for wages, $16 an hour for their low-wage workers. That's an 11% raise on average for 5,700 people. Now, they don't have to do that, but they think they're going to have an advantage by doing that, that they're going to have more retention, you know, less recruiting, less retraining, that they'll actually save money by paying their workers a little more. If we start to see those kinds of decisions across the economy, then suddenly this story of stagnant wage growth, you know, no real inflation-adjusted wage gains, that story will end if more employers start to conclude that they have to get ahead of things and offer raises to get the workers they need.
About a minute before our first break here, we have a tweet from Joshua. Can you talk about what the middle class actually means? We've been throwing these terms around, Mark Zandi. What does it mean to be middle class?
Well, probably a good benchmark is the median income, household income in the United States. So half of households make more, half make less, and that's $55,000 a year. So that's for the nation. Obviously, it varies quite a bit depending on where you live. New York is higher incomes versus Iowa, where you have lower incomes, lower cost of living, and lower incomes. But that would be a pretty good benchmark for defining where the middle class,
The middle of the middle class. Yeah. So maybe it goes to 40 up to 60, 70,
exactly.
Maybe 80.
In that range.
Yep. Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are exploring the state of the U.S. economy. Mark Zandi here with us in our Philadelphia studio, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, wrote a book a couple of years ago called Paying the Price, Ending the Great Recession and Beginning a New American Century. Neil Irwin is senior economic correspondent at the New York Times, The Upshot. He wrote a book called The Alchemist, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire. We'll take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Lines open to join our conversation. That phone number 1-888-477-9499. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Neil Irwin and Mark Zandi about the U.S. economy, some of the strengths, some of the weaknesses, and both of them sharing an optimistic view, looking into the future with perhaps a greater or even continuing fall in the unemployment rate, and also the possibility that wages look like they could be going up. And again, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Mark, I just want to share with you share with our listeners what you and I were talking about during the break, which is, yes, this jobless rate is 5.6%, a dramatic difference from, 2000?
Yeah, exactly.
But that doesn't include everybody who is looking for work or even out of work.
Yeah, there's more slack, as they would say, in the job market than that 5.6% unemployment would represent. Those are people that are looking for work and can't find it. There are people who have stepped out of the workforce. They're not looking for work, but they would want a job if one presented itself. You know, they've been looking for the right kind of job, pay has been too low to pay for commute costs and all the other costs of working. And then there's so those are folks that slack there. And then there are folks that are working part time that would certainly like to work full time. They just can't get the hours. So if you kind of add up all of the slack in the labor market, it's probably about 1%, maybe a little more than 1% of the workforce. So we still have work to do. We're not there yet. But at the current rate of job growth, if we create another 3 million jobs in 2015 like we did in 2014, we'll be pretty close to absorbing that 1% of the labor force by this time next year. Not quite there, but pretty close.
Neil, do we have an economy that creates mass? Yes, it's great to have 3 million new jobs in 2014 and hopefully for 2015. I sometimes wonder whether we can create enough jobs for all the people that want to work.
Yeah, and part of it, it's partly a mystery. How many of the people who left the labor force in the last 6-7 years, how many of them are ever going to come back? How many of them really want to come back? How many of them will the right opportunities arise that they say, you know, I do want to work again? If you got laid off from a high-paying factory job in 2008 and you haven't really been working since then, you know, what's it going to take for you to consider coming back into the labor force? Maybe you don't want to work at a retailer for $7 an hour, but are the jobs going to start to arise that pay a little better where you say, you know, I am back in the labor force. I am gonna work, and that is one of the great mysteries. One number a lot of us look at is the employment to population ratio. So it's just the number of people who have a job compared to the total adult population in the U.S. and that fell 5 percentage points from the beginning of the recession to the trough. It's only rebounded 1% of that. So that's 4% of the population that potentially could come back into the labor force. Now, there are some demographic changes. The baby boomers are retiring. We don't know for sure how much of that is demographic and how much of it is the weak economy of the last few years. But it's one of the great unanswered questions and really has an important impact on what is the long-term potential of the U.S. economy. How fast will we grow in the future? How big will our economy be in the future? A big part of that answer depends on how many of these missing workers come back into the labor force.
And do you think they're waiting for that $16 an hour, for instance, Neil?
I think they are. I think, you know, there's a lot of people who, you know, have not found it worthwhile to work. Maybe they're, you know, nearing retirement age, but not quite in the traditional retirement age, and are going to make their decision based on what's out there. And if there's a feeling that employers are really looking for workers, that they're offering wages, offering raises to get people in the door, then you might see a lot of those people re-enter the labor force. That'll create some upward pressure actually on the unemployment rate. So as those people re-enter the labor force, we might see the unemployment rate drop less quickly than it has been over the last couple of years.
Interesting. We have a question from Kevin. Are there specific industries that are benefiting in job growth that people can tap into? Are there industries that are going faster than others? I'm tossing that to you, Mark.
Well, one of the hallmarks of the current job market is it's pretty much across the board. The strength is pretty much across the board. We're seeing good, solid job growth in lots of different industries, everything from low-paying jobs, retail, leisure and hospitality, to high-paying jobs in the technology sector, the professional services sector, to middle-paying jobs. We're even starting to see some job creation in local government, so we're hiring back some of those K-12 teachers that lost jobs during the downturn. So it's very broad-based. There are some soft spots. Now, the energy sector is now a soft spot, so I wouldn't go looking for a job in the energy sector anytime soon. That's going to be tough. You know, the media industry, obviously, you know this better than I do, Marty. It's under a lot of pressure because of the internet. But I'm stretching. I mean, in general, the job market is good, and it's good pretty much across the board.
I'm looking at a piece, Neil, that was actually in your paper today. Oxfam study finds the richest 1% is likely to control half of global wealth by 2016. The 80 wealthiest people in the world altogether own $1.9 trillion, nearly the same amount shared by 3.5 billion people who occupy the bottom half. So the world is sort of the sort of larger picture of what's going on in the United States in terms of income inequality.
Yeah, I mean, what's happening in the U.S. and what's happening in the world, they track each other. You know, some of those statistics can overstate the inequality problem. Actually, globally, if you look across the world, extreme poverty is declining rapidly. You have the growth of more and more middle class, middle income people in countries like China and India and Brazil. So there is good news on the global economy in terms of less dire poverty, more people with middle class standards of living. But there's no question that if you look at wealth as opposed to incomes, you see some pretty dramatic divides and more, you know, truly vast sums of wealth in the hands of a relatively small number of people.
And how should we define wealth, Mark Zandi?
That's a good question,
besides
too.
Besides just money in your top drawer.
Well, here, this is really testing my statistical acumen.
Okay.
So the median household net worth, so that is what I own less what I owe, is probably somewhere around $75,000, $100,000. That doesn't feel like a lot, right? Mm-hmm. Particularly if you're worried about retirement. But it is very – that's the median. That's half a net worth higher, half lower. The average, so this would be affected by those very wealthy individuals, is probably closer to $600,000.
Wow.
So that gives you a sense of how skewed the distribution of wealth is. It's even more skewed, as Neil pointed out, than the distribution of income. Wealth is much more skewed.
But that, I mean, that it sounds like, Neil, you wanted to add something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the lessons of Thomas Piketty's book last year that was the subject of so much discussion, is that great wealth can create its own kind of self-reinforcing cycle. And so you have these dynamics where, for example, if you have, $10, $100 million in the bank, whatever income you have coming in, you don't have to spend it all. You know, it's very easy if you have $1 million a year coming into your pocket to only spend a small portion of that to live very comfortably. Whereas if you're making $30,000 a year, you need to spend pretty much every dime just to get by. So people with great wealth can, because they don't have to spend as large a percentage of their income just to live comfortably, can actually that wealth can kind of cascade and turn into a much larger number. And that's one of the dynamics that's feeding these kinds of numbers you see, like those out of Oxfam.
But it seems to me, Mark, that income inequality cannot be good for an economy overall. That if there's this huge disparity between rich people and poor people and some struggling middle class people, that can't be good for an economy, can it?
I think you're right. I mean, certainly if it gets to the point where the very wealthy, the very high income households are able to change the rules of the game, and this is a concern. A number of good economists have spent a lot of energy on this topic, demonstrating that wealthy individuals are capturing to some degree the political process, and then they can change the rules. And if they can change the rules, they bend them in their favor, and this becomes even more of an issue going forward. Another concern is that it can't be healthy if such a large share is going to the top part of the income and wealth distribution, because the rest of the population just won't be able to spend and the economy can't flourish. This is kind of Henry Ford actually recognized this with the Model T, right? He saw that, you know, if I'm going to be able to sell Model Ts, I've got to have workers who can afford the Model T. And so there was there's a bit of an issue with that. Now it's a matter of degree, right? I mean, we're always going to have income and wealth inequality, and to some degree, it's a motivational force too. I mean, that's part of the American dream, that if you have opportunity, that you can go out and get an education and be entrepreneurial and make a lot of money and be successful. So, you know, there's some benefit to that, but, you know, that goes to a certain point, and after that, it becomes counterproductive.
What do you think, Neil?
Well, I'd just add that that this debate and this discussion is getting to the heart of our political debate, too. Tonight at the State of the Union, the president is going to be announcing a tax proposal that would very directly aim at this situation. And the strategy is to raise the capital gains tax rate to make it harder for people to pass on capital gains tax-free to their heirs. So that affects the very tippy top of the income scale. And then use that to pay for working-class tax credits for working parents, for the earned income tax credit. So this is the president. Now, look, it's a Republican Congress for the next 2 years. There's no way this is going to be enacted. But this is the president saying, I'm going to take these critiques of inequality and how it's evolving in America and propose a policy directly targeted at addressing that and trying to change that equation a little bit. And I think what we're seeing are signs that this will be the central political debate of the next 2 years going into the 2016 election. You've seen in Jeb Bush's initial push toward possibly running for president, he's talking a lot about Republican and conservative solutions to inequality and trying to create opportunity for entrepreneurship, that sort of thing. This is the president's approach. We'll see if Hillary Clinton, if other Democratic candidates embrace a similar approach. But we may be seeing the early signs of this dilemma that we've been talking about of middle class wage stagnation, no real wage gains for middle and lower income Americans for a generation, really. We might see that coming to the fore of the political debate and kind of setting the frame for the 2016 election.
Well, I've even heard Neil Marco Rubio talking about this, even Mitt Romney. Romney has been talking about income inequality, and I think the Republicans are blaming Obama, President Obama, for that situation in the United States.
Yeah, and it's a complicated set of reasons that things have worked this way. I would say that the inequality shifts really predate Obama and have been emerging for decades rather than just since he took office. But I think this is a good debate to be having. I think we're zeroing in on something that maybe was true in the mid-2000s, but was masked by the fact that we had this housing bubble. People had rising wealth from their home, and the stock market was doing well. So I think some of this got masked back 10 years ago, and it's really a debate that may be overdue.
Yeah, I think the good news is that I think Republican, Democrat, everyone is now focused on this as an issue. Now, different groups have different policy prescriptions and how to address it. President Obama in his State of the Union apparently is going to be focused on the tax code as a way to address it. A minimum wage is another way to try to address it. Republican candidates are more focused on trying to provide job opportunities, entrepreneurship, educational opportunities. I think the reality is that it's all of the above, right? Hmm. This is a big problem that's going to take a lot of different solutions. It's not just one thing, and we're going to have to tackle it in lots of different ways. So I think I'm actually quite encouraged that the debate is – we're in a debate first about this, and secondly, that we are getting lots of interesting ideas. And I'm hopeful that we'll get some policy response that will ultimately address this issue.
And that's Mark Zandi, who joins us along with Neil Irwin. We are talking about the U.S. economy, giving a bit of a preview to President Obama's State of the Union address, which is tonight. We'll be talking more about that tomorrow morning on Radio Times. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We have an email from Edward. He says, what do your guests make of the analysis of Joseph Stiglitz on what is wrong with our economic system? Stiglitz is arguing that our systems of law and taxation favor rent seeking, I'm not sure what that means, over production of goods and services. And Stiglitz is a critic of I guess the system as it is currently constructed. Mark, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, actually, this was what I was referring to earlier. He actually wrote a very good book documenting, arguing that the wealthy class potentially could capture the political process and change the rules. And so he's the largest proponent of that idea. I actually interviewed him at the Philadelphia.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, yeah.
At the Free Library?
At the Free Library. It was quite fascinating. You know, my own view on this is that there's truth to what he says, but it's probably overdone. And that our system is actually quite adjusts. So we had a very similar issue, I think, back in the 1920s, the last time the distribution of income got as skewed as it is today, and for many of the same reasons. And our political process adjusted to that and addressed it. Now, of course, there may have been other broader forces at work, like World War II, that may have intervened. But I do think that he has a point. We have to be wary and cognizant of that in the context of all policy, that we have to look at policy through that prism. But I think his perspective is a bit overdone, at least from my perspective. He didn't. Let's put it this way: he didn't completely convince me after I read the book.
Well, and I don't know if you want to weigh in on that, Neil. But I have a question for you, which is: why don't we just treat all income the same? Whether you get it from stocks, whether you get it from inheritance, whether you get it from going to work, why do we have all these different categories for how people make a living?
Yeah, that's actually an interesting – it speaks to the Stiglitz argument. The simplest example of this differential treatment between capital and labor, as it were, is the capital gains tax rate is 20%. And that means if you buy one asset and sell it a year later, you pay 20% on the profits. Whereas the top tax rate on income, if you work a job and get paid, is nearly 40%, 39.6%.
Right.
So the question is, why should you pay twice as much tax if you're working for a living? If you're, if you're a CEO actually out there working versus if you're out there just investing and putting money down at risk. And I think, the argument is that low investment taxes, low capital gains taxes encourage investment, encourage a kind of risk taking that enables our economy to be more dynamic in the long run. And there's something to that. I mean, there is evidence that having low taxes on capital gains does create more investment, more innovation, more a more vibrant economy. The problem is it hasn't really helped that that much this last 15 years. And we've seen this period in which even the early 2000s recovery was not all that great. We had this horrible recession. We've had this tepid recovery since then. And that's all been in a time of a very low capital gains tax rate. So the question is, well, what kind of economy is that low tax rate buying us? Mm-hmm. Should the tax on capital be something more similar to what it is on income? That's actually exactly what the president's proposing, though not quite up to that top rate. And I think that's one of the great questions that will evolve going forward. What should our tax policies be, and should there be this difference in approach for capital versus labor?
I see you nodding your head a little bit.
I think Neil's got it exactly right. I guess the only other thing I would add to try to explain the differential tax rates is that corporate income, the profits that companies earn, is in some sense taxed twice, right? It's taxed at the corporate level. That income is then distributed to shareholders in the form of dividends and through capital gains. And so then that's taxed again. So the thinking is that you're taxing the returns to capital, to business, more than once, and therefore you would want to keep the capital gains rate and the dividend rate lower, which, by the way, is why I think it's very important that we have corporate tax reform, which isn't part of the president's speech, and to some degree is, from my perspective, disappointing. I mean, in my view, if what we've heard about his speech is what we're going to hear tonight, it feels like small ball to me.
You know, really?
Yeah, it really does. I mean, it's $300 billion over 10 years in tax cuts, you know, distributing, raising taxes on wealthy and providing tax breaks for middle-income households. But $300 billion in over 10 years in our economy is nothing. And it's not going to result in any more jobs, any higher standards of living a year from now, 5 years or 10 years from now. So it doesn't feel like to me that this is really getting – it's not a broad-based, this is what we need to do to change the game. And to do that, we would need something like corporate tax reform, and then you would consider, you know, some of these issues in the context of that. But you know, obviously, I'm an economist, not
sure.
A politician.
So no, clearly,
I don't understand the politics. But as from an economic perspective, it feels like small.
You're saying
ball.
go bigger.
What is this about? Right? Yeah.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Also with us, Neil Irwin, senior economic correspondent at the New York Times. The upshot, and yes, we are talking about the U.S. economy, what can be done to strengthen it. We've been talking about some of the strengths and some of the weaknesses, and again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and talking with Neil Irwin and Mark Zandi about the U.S. economy. The Labor Department reported that just about 250,000 jobs were added in December, helping to bring the jobless rate down to 5.6%. That's the lowest level since 2008. Low oil prices also mean that consumers have a little more disposable income. But some are worried about things like stagnant wages, which we've been talking about, and the weak global economy, I do want to spend a little more time on that, could derail a full recovery. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Lots of social media as well, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Wendy from, is that Collegeville on Radio Times? Wendy, go ahead, you're on the air.
Great. My question is, what happens to people's expectations when economic conditions improve? Are they satisfied? Do they want more? Are they angry at what happened to them? What happens to people's expectations economically?
Wendy, I'm going to toss that to Neil Irwin to see if he can weigh in on that. And this is perhaps the kind of psychology of the U.S. economy.
Yeah, you know, we're seeing in all the survey data some real improvement in the last 2-3 months. It's remarkable how fast some of the consumer confidence measures, even the president's approval rating, have come up. And there's a lot of evidence for that. When conditions are improving, when people are able to get a job, when gas prices are falling, it really does affect people's mood, people's confidence in the future. You know, it's funny seeing how this trickles out, and whether there's a kind of virtuous cycle that might happen is a very interesting thing to watch. You know, does this greater optimism, you see both in consumer surveys, also business surveys, CEOs are more confident than they were even a year ago. Does that translate into more hiring, more pay raises, more people entering the labor force, more people taking risks and investment and investing? I think that's one of the possible upside surprises for 2015. Even the trajectory things are on already is pretty solid. We might see see some really rapid growth if you see some of that that dynamic take hold.
But, Mark, I can imagine someone that isn't really feeling the effects of this good economy saying to themselves, what are they talking about here?
Yeah, sure.
You know, my lot in life isn't any better.
And there's been a lot of that, right? I mean, and it goes mostly to wage growth, I think. I mean, now most people who want a job have a job. Not everybody, but the unemployment rate is down. So for most people, it's about my pay. Is it bigger than it was last year? And is the rate of increase keeping pace with my cost of living, with everything else that I have to pay for? And up to this point, for most people, the answer is, my pay is barely keeping pace with inflation. I'm barely treading water. You know, my kind of general standard of living is going nowhere. I don't feel great about that. Mm-hmm. And they talk about more jobs, better job, lower unemployment. That doesn't really mean anything to me. But if we're now at a point where wage growth is going to start to accelerate, and again, I think we're there, then I think more and more people will recognize that their economy is better, and that will be reflected in consumer confidence and approval ratings and that kind of thing. And by the way, it may already be happening because, as Neil pointed out, consumer confidence is now as high as it's been since before the recession. Business confidence is as high as it's ever been in the data that I look at.
Than it's ever been.
Ever been. And so, that is an indication that wage growth is already picking up and that we'll start to see that in the data in the not-too-distant future.
I would add, go ahead, Neil. So the recession technically ended in mid-2009, and that's something economists look at of when is there a trough and when does growth resume. But for years, whenever I would say on TV or on the radio that, oh, the recession ended, or in an article, the emails I would get of people saying, what are you talking about? You're insane. The recession isn't over at all. And I think the fact that people are kind of accepting that's a reasonable description of things now is a sign of how far things have come.
Neil, let me tell something back to you, which is the effect of the European economy on the U.S. economy. The dollar is stronger. I don't exactly understand what Switzerland did, but I know it was important. I don't know if we get into the depths of it. But as you look across Europe, and of course Europe is a very important trading partner with the United States, what do you see?
Yeah, so the central problem in Europe is they have a single currency across this continent with all these different countries, with all these different economic circumstances. And normally the currencies are adjustments or the way that these imbalances between these different countries can work themselves out. And they're trying to work out a bunch of imbalances in other ways. And the result is that they have a one-size-fits-all monetary policy coming out of Frankfurt at the European Central Bank that is not really appropriate for big chunks of the continent. So you have very high unemployment in places like Greece, Spain, Italy, you have a relative strength in Northern Europe. And figuring out where this goes is a great challenge. So it looks like the European Central Bank is going to take some new effort to try and stimulate growth this week. On Thursday, they meet. It looks like they will join the Federal Reserve and do quantitative easing and buy vast sums of assets using newly created money to try and pump money into the European economy and try and get the continent's growth on track. Might they be too late? Might it be too small and too timid in what they're going to try and do? That's an open question. But it has really big stakes for the U.S. As you say, it's a major trading partner, but it's also one of the other kind of great advanced economies of the world. And it's hard to have a truly robust global economic recovery when one of the world's mm-hmm. major economies is stuck in the situation they're in.
Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I think Europe is – I'm optimistic, but this is the most significant threat to my
You're
optimism.
You're always optimistic,
Am I
have to say.
But I've been right. Yeah, yeah. It's been – we've been steadily improving.
You've been on enough that I know this about you.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think we did talk before the crash, and it wasn't optimistic
no,
times
it wasn't,
then.
No, not so much.
But I think Europe is the most significant threat to our prospects. What I worry about most in Europe is unemployment is so high, and it's been so high for so long, particularly for young people. You go into Italy or Spain, the youth unemployment rate is 30, 40, 50%, similarly in Greece. And you can see this boiling over in the political process. So if you go into any of the countries, there are these splinter political factions that are developing. Podemos in Spain, Syriza in Greece, UKIP in the UK, the National Front in France. And I think the risk is that they gain a voice, a political voice, and that could lead to a fracturing of the Eurozone, breaking apart. I think the odds of that happening are still quite low. I think they'll keep it together. But that's what I worry most about, that the turmoil – the financial turmoil coming out of Europe isn't over, and we're going to be faced with that again here in the United States, and we're going to have to grapple with that.
And if you're talking about unemployment rates, youth unemployment rates, 30, 40, even 50%, you can't start your career. You can't, you know, build any kind of a nest egg under those conditions.
Oh, and, you know, we saw that here in the United States. The millennial generation started behind the financial eight ball, right? They graduated from school trying to get a job in the middle of this mess. And they started off, many of them couldn't find jobs. Many of them are... You know, stuck living with parents. Not that that's a bad thing, but, you know,
they may not want to be there
for too long. We have the same issue here to a much lesser degree.
Let me get, looks like Carlos from Percy to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Carlos. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. I'm interested in finding out what your guests think about companies like GE that hire a legion of accountants to minimize the taxes they pay, and other companies like Tyco that are offshore, like in Bermuda, also for the same purpose, to minimize the amount of taxes they pay. They have to pay. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
You're welcome, Carlos. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Neil Urban talking about companies in a sense sort of offshoring and its effect on the U.S. economy.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, look, a company's job is to minimize taxes. They're not supposed to – there's no reason you would pay more than you have to pay, just as individuals do. You know, I take all the deductions I'm eligible for and try and minimize taxes. The question is, is the tax code designed poorly to allow companies to evade what are perfectly reasonable taxes? And that's a question that Mark mentioned earlier, corporate tax reform can help address and create a tax code that has fewer of these loopholes that companies can use to get away from things. And then there's a question of, you know, if you're a U.S. company and you grew up here and you benefit from the U.S. education system and the U.S. infrastructure system and the U.S. Legal system, courts, all of those good things that the U.S. has that makes this a good place to do business, do you have some patriotic duty to not exploit a hole by repatriating your theoretical technical headquarters to another country? I think that gets into an argument that is more in the moral sphere than the economic sphere, but it's certainly one that's risen to the top of the surface in Washington lately.
I mean, it seems this. I mean, Mark, you were talking about powerful people using their power to their benefit. It just seems sort of unfair on the face of it.
Well, I wouldn't blame the companies, right? They're just doing what we all would do. We're trying to limit our tax liability. I would blame our corporate tax code.
It's, you know, blame Congress, I guess.
Well,
yeah. They write the tax code,
don't they? All of us. I mean, they represent us and they reflect us. The corporate tax code is very inefficient and creates all these kinds of distortions. Everyone knows it. And actually, there's a lot of bipartisan support around changing it. The president wants to change it. He came up with a proposal a couple of years ago. The Republicans wanted to change it in the last Congress. David Camp, who was a major player in this, came up with a proposal. They're actually, interestingly enough, not that far apart. So I'm hopeful that if we have more stories like companies buying other companies to avoid overseas companies to avoid taxes, that this will be the catalyst for that political change necessary to get corporate tax reform. I think that should be at the top. So going back to the president's State of the Union address, that's where I would have, if I were king for the day, I think that's where
you
I would
focus up
on
front
it.
There.
And then you can bring in the other things, is other priorities, whether you agree with them or not, you could bring them into that broader context.
We have an email from Gary saying, what specific minor issues can the Obama administration and both houses work on to reduce gridlock and improve the economy? And just picking up, Neil, on what Mark was saying, do you think even if there is agreement on some of these issues, that there's enough, what is the word? I don't know, desire to actually pass legislation to make the changes that people say that they want?
You know, it's interesting. I looked after the elections where the Republicans took the Senate last November. I looked at the track record of the last 2 years of a second term administration, and especially where there's a opposing party in Congress. That happened for Reagan. It happened for Clinton. Happened for George W. Bush. And the track record is that not much gets done, but it's not that nothing can get done. And the things that do get done tend to be areas where the opposing party is more enthusiastic than the president's party. So classic example right now is trade deals. So there's the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a giant trade deal with a bunch of Asian and South American countries that the U.S. has been negotiating. That a lot of Democrats have concerns about and feel like might not do enough to protect labor, but the president has been negotiating it, his people have, and think it's something that will make the U.S. economy more competitive and give our companies better access to Asia and countries overseas. So that's something that Republicans are actually more enthusiastic about than most Democrats in Congress. So that's an area where we might see some legislation actually happen.
Cyber terrorism might be another area, right? Because this is another major threat. And you talk about black swans, that could be a very significant black swan. And I think there's a lot of consensus, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's legislation on that front as well coming out of this Congress.
Mark, let me ask you about housing starts, something that you have written about, saying that they have not been as robust, I think, as people were hoping. Of course, it was the housing crisis that, in a sense, sort of brought down the economy. Why do you think slow to recover? Or slower to recover?
Lots of reasons. I think there's a lot of psychological scars from the bust. You know, people are a little bit wary of owning a single-family home. Of course, the recession was very hard on middle-income, low-income households, and their credit scores have been nailed. And lenders are very cautious for lots of reasons in extending credit unless the borrower has very pristine credit history and other good financials. And there's a lot of, you know, builders are building big homes for lots of reasons, not building small homes at reasonable price points. So a lot of things going on, a melange of things, unfortunate things have come together, conspired to keep construction low. But the demographic tailwinds here are quite powerful. You've got a lot of people who are sitting out there that will form households. I talked about those millennials, right?
Yes.
They're not going to stay with their parents forever. And once they form households, now that won't go into a single family home, that'll go into a multifamily apartment. But you know, that's part of the process. So I'm expecting construction activity to pick up. And that's one reason I'm optimistic. I think that will offset some of the negatives from energy and from what's going on overseas.
Neil, I wonder whether young people or first-time homeowners are – or potential homeowners are reluctant just because – looking back over the last five or six years, do I want to be saddled with a mortgage in this part of the country knowing that something could happen to my job or there might be a better job somewhere else?
Yeah, that said, you know, building apartments, building rental properties is construction activity as well. And as Mark notes, you know, you can start a household by renting, not necessarily by buying, and that can still contribute to economic growth. I'll be honest, I've been surprised at how slow home building activity has been to come back. If you look, residential investment, so total spending on housing-related things, is still far below its long-term average as a percentage of GDP. I thought, you know, now that the excesses of the housing boom have largely been worked out, I thought that would rebound more sharply than it has. You know, so that's at least, I guess, to put a silver lining on it, that's an area of growth in the future that we might look forward.
And if rents keep going up, I don't know if they are, but if they get sort of out of reach, then I guess owning a home would become more attractive.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. And actually, rent growth is strong. It's now 3% year over year and accelerating. And actually, I think our biggest problem a year or two from now is going to be a shortage of housing. We're just because we're going to have more households formed and just less units. And actually, vacancy rates have been declining and are at 20-25 year lows. And as a result, our problem. You know, our problem a few years ago in the bubble was too many vacant homes. Now it's too few, and that's going to become more of an issue going forward.
So, Neil, you'll be watching the president tonight. What will you be listening for?
You know, I think I'll be listening for any sign that he has a path forward to enact some of the ideas he's going to mention. You know, some things, like I mentioned, trade, Mark mentioned cyber terrorism, there is clear room for bipartisan agreement. Some of these things he's going to talk about are really more about framing the discussion for years ahead, even after he's out of office, rather than some actual policy outcome in the next 2 years. So I'll be listening for anything else that Republicans might actually pass.
Well, on that note, Neil Irwin, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Senior economic correspondent at the New York Times. The New York Times, The Upshot. Also wrote a book called The Alchemist, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire. Mark Zandi, thank you very much
for
joining us as well. Chief economist at Moody's Analytics. And he wrote a book a couple of years ago, Paying the Price, Ending the Great Recession and Beginning a New American Century. We appreciate those phone calls and many email comments as well and tweets as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can carry on this conversation. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times and do stay with us. We'll be right back.